This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Richard Dawkins is an atheist. His book, The God Delusion, sold more than a million copies in English and sparked heated debate about the nature of man and religion. But Richard Dawkins is also a scientist, a former Oxford University biologist who has now set out to defend the theory of evolution, which has come under increasing attack in the United States. Darwin published his theory 150 years ago, but today, 44% of Americans believe that God created man in his present form within the last 10,000 years. 42% believe that life has existed on Earth in its present form since the beginning of time. They ignore Darwin because, after all, he merely posited a theory. So Richard Dawkins is trying to set the record straight with his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program and welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you.
That 44% figure, 44% of Americans believe that God created man in his present form within the last 10,000 years. That comes from a 2008 Gallup poll of Americans. Is America alone in that belief?
The figures for Britain are somewhat lower. If you look at the league table of advanced countries, America is right down there with Turkey. Only Turkey shows worse figures. I forget exactly what the figure for Turkey is. But all other advanced countries are higher on the list of accepting science as opposed to dogmatic scripture.
Has it always been that high in America, or do you know? Is it growing, or do you know?
It's been pretty much the same for about the last 20 years in America. If you look at Gallup polls going back to the 1980s, the figures are hovering around 40-45%.
To what do you attribute that?
It would be presumptuous of me as a non-American to try to fathom that.
Well, okay, it's a spreading belief, because as you say, it is spreading, it's growing in Britain. It's growing
I'm not sure it's growing, actually. As I said, in the 1980s, it was pretty similar. So it may be the same. The publicity it's getting is growing, I think.
Okay. You say that this belief, this 44%, and I believe you call them the 44%ers, don't you?
And the history deniers.
And the history deniers.
Yes.
That this should concern not only scientists, but it should concern religious leaders.
Well, it does concern religious leaders a lot. I mean, I've spoken to the Archbishop of Canterbury about it, for example. Mm-hmm. These people cannot believe the rubbish that is being taught by uneducated, by people who are religious but uneducated in theology. Sophisticated theologians all accept the fact of evolution.
Hmm. Why should it concern religious leaders? Why should it bother them?
Because it gets them a bad name. I mean, they have to get used to their religion, which they hold dear, being written off as idiocy because there are idiots who believe the world is 10,000 years old.
And yet you do so, you lay some of the blame at their feet, because you do talk about how preachers will get up in the pulpit, and even though they believe fully in evolution and know and have figured out a way to work it into their own religious beliefs, they get up and they quote scripture which doesn't account for, does not take evolution into account, with no explanation to the congregants there in the church.
Yeah. They have figured it out, and the way they figured it out is to make it symbolic. So they will say the book of Genesis is a symbolic account, a poetic account of the way the world began. But you're absolutely right. What they do when they get into the pulpit is they forget to say that. Hmm. They assume that their audience will realize that they're speaking symbolically, allegorically. And instead, they speak as if it was literal, and their congregation interpret it as literal. And that's, I think, part of the problem. If only the bishops and theologians would lay it on the line and say, of course you do understand, don't you, that we're only speaking symbolically. But they don't do that.
Well, the Church of England and the Catholic Church worldwide is probably a little different. And I don't know how it really is in Britain, but I know that in this country there are religious denominations that take the Bible literally. And if you take the Bible literally, would you then have to discount the theory of evolution?
Of course, if you take the Bible literally. And this is one of the problems with Islam. They have to take the Quran literally. And that may be why Turkey is the only advanced country that is even worse than the United States in this regard.
Well, how then do, because you have had these conversations and you've written articles with the Bishop of Canterbury, how has the Church of England and the Episcopal Church and the Catholic Church and some of the other major denominations, how have they come to terms with this?
Okay, first, I've written articles with the Bishop of Oxford.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But the Archbishop of Canterbury would certainly agree. How have they come to terms with it? The question was,
how have they integrated evolution into theology?
They say that God started the universe off, and evolution is, some of them will actually say that evolution is God's way of doing his creation, and what God did was to set up a universe in which the laws of physics were so fine-tuned mm-hmm. that evolution would eventually start. And they kind of foresaw it. Some of them will go further and suggest that maybe God guides evolution a little bit here and there where it needs a little bit of help or something of that sort.
You're a scientist. So I would think that these conversations would frustrate you, the need to have these conversations. But you're also an atheist. I would think that really frustrates you that you have to have these conversations. How do you deal with this in your own
head?
I'm
frustrated on behalf of science teachers, and I hear stories from science teachers pretty much every day as I do a tour of the United States. Teachers will come up to me and say that they have to fight a kind of rearguard action when they're trying to teach their subject of science, trying to teach their subject of biology, and they have to face a sort of yapping chorus of parents officials on committees and the children themselves who have been brainwashed into believing that scripture, something that somebody wrote down a couple of thousand years ago, should take precedence over scientific evidence. That is intensely frustrating for a teacher of science who's trying to teach her subject.
You spoke last night to a gathered group of people, and I've been given some information about what you talked about, and one of the things that you said, children should demand and search for evidence to support their beliefs instead of believing something that was, quote, scribbled down by a tribe of Middle Eastern goat herders.
Absolutely right.
Them's yeah. fighting words.
Is they? I mean... Well, I stand by them absolutely. Children should be taught to think for themselves. Children should be taught to ask the question, what is the evidence for what you've just told me? Is it the kind of thing for which there is evidence? Of course, a child can't necessarily be expected to understand the details of the evidence. I mean, I can't understand the evidence for quantum theory, for example. Okay. But I do know that the scientific enterprise has a procedure in place, peer review. I know that there are physicists who are capable of evaluating the evidence for quantum theory.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I know scientists have explained this many times, but it still doesn't seem to sink through. And the people who cling to the idea that the Earth is 10,000 years old, and I once had a geologist on this program, not this program, but another program that I've done in the past, who sat there and told me that the Earth was 10,000 years old and that carbon dating is nonsense, and he had ways to prove it. And he taught at the university level, which was odd.
Shocking.
Yeah. But there are those who believe that the theory of evolution doesn't hold water because it is just a theory.
Got that again.
Yes. So as a scientist, explain how scientists use the term theory.
It's a most unfortunate mismatch between two uses of English. In common language, theory means a sort of tentative hypothesis which is yet to be proved. In the way a scientist uses it, it's a body of evidence. It's a solid structure for which there is a huge amount of evidence. Technically speaking, philosophers will tell you that you can never actually prove anything. Mm-hmm. All you can do is fail to disprove something. And the longer you've been working at trying to disprove it, the more convincing does it become. Technically speaking, it's only a theory that the world is round and not flat. It's a theory that's never been disproved, and we all know it never will be disproved. Yeah. It is a fact that the world is round and not flat. Evolution is in exactly the same category.
I believe you also say it's only a theory that the moon is smaller than the sun, even though it appears to be...
It's only a theory. Yeah. But once again, it's a theory that has not been disproved. It never will be disproved. We all know it's a fact. Evolution is a fact in exactly the same sense.
In your book, you write, evolution is a fact beyond reasonable doubt, beyond serious doubt, beyond sane, informed, intelligent doubt, beyond doubt, evolution is a fact. Aside from the sentence sounding very frustrated to me and wanting to prove your point, why does it matter Why does it matter if people don't believe that it's a fact?
Because the truth matters. You might say, why does it matter if you believe that the world is flat? Technically, it doesn't matter unless you happen to want to visit Australia. But I think it matters because the truth is beautiful. It's a privilege to be allowed to learn about the truth. Every child should have that privilege. It is, I think, a form of child abuse to deprive a child of the opportunity to know something about this beautiful universe, this elegant universe in which we live. And my theologian friends tell me that it's also an abuse of theology.
You don't seem to have much at stake in terms of accepting evolution because you're an atheist. For those people who take the Bible literally, accepting evolution calls into question not only their beliefs, but in many cases, who they identify as a person. So for those people, how do you make it less fearful to accept evolution as a fact?
I have a certain amount of sympathy for that. In a way, it's putting the cart before the horse to say, you are an atheist, therefore. I mean, I'm an atheist because I've looked at the evidence. The evidence for me always should come first, and it should come first for everybody. But I do have sympathy for people whose entire life has been devoted to a particular belief system, which, if they look at the evidence, they may discover is erroneous. Mm-hmm. And it becomes even worse when you reflect that their whole family, their whole support system is committed to this same belief. Mm-hmm. And I've heard people say, I'm an atheist, but I daren't come out. You only ever hear this in America or in the Islamic world. You don't hear it in Britain or Europe. But in America, I frequently hear people say, well, I'm an atheist, but I've never dared say it because it would kill my aged mother. And I do sympathize with that. I think it is literally tragic that a belief system, which has no basis in fact, no basis in evidence, should have taken such a grip on people's minds that to deny it is like getting a divorce or worse.
Yeah.
And I do think that's tragic, and it's something that we need to think very seriously about.
As a scientist, why are you an atheist and not an agnostic?
That's a very good question. We all are agnostic about so many things. I mean, technically speaking, we can't disprove the existence of fairies and unicorns and the Easter Bunny. But none of us believe that, so we don't say, I'm agnostic about fairies. We say, I don't believe in fairies. And the same is true of all gods. We are all of us, after all, atheists. We don't believe in Thor. We don't believe in Apollo. We don't believe in Zeus. We don't believe in Mithras. Technically we are agnostic about Thor. Mm-hmm. We can't disprove that thunder is made by Thor and his hammer, and he's just sort of, you know, the electrical discharges are kind of there as well, or something of that sort. You can't disprove a million things, but you don't waste your time believing in things like Thor and fairies. And the same is true for me of whichever god you happen to be talking about when you use the word god.
You've written about other things other than evolution. It just so happens that the greatest show on earth is devoted to explaining and proving beyond a shadow of a doubt why evolution exists, and you lay out the whole fossil record, etc. But does the fact that people know you're an atheist, Richard Dawkins, does that hinder you in your ability to spread the gospel according to science?
Probably, and it therefore might be a little unfortunate that you introduced me by saying...
Do you think it was unfair? Should I have left that
No,
out?
No, it's not unfair at all. It's a fact. I'm not ashamed of it. I mean, a revealing anecdote. The actress Julia Sweeney, who has a wonderful one-woman show...
Can you hold that anecdote for just a second? Because we have to take a break. I'm very sorry.
Okay,
we'll come back to that in a moment. Richard Dawkins is our guest, fellow of the Royal Society and the Royal Society of Literature, and author of The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution.
Support for this rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bernhard Furniture Company, Lenoir, North Carolina, in honor of the quasi-centennial anniversary of the company's founding in 1889. Family owned and operated for 125 years. Bernhard.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, AI. It's the stuff of science fiction, but artificial intelligence is real and getting better. It's more than asking Siri a question and getting an intelligent answer. It's more than saying, okay, Google now, and getting directions. Artificial intelligence means computers that actually think like humans. And that has some humans worried. We'll talk about the practical applications and ethical considerations of AI when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, armed U.S. drones begin flying over Iraq to protect American military advisors. And President Obama seeks authorization for military training and equipment for Syrian opposition fighters. An update on U.S. involvement in Iraq and Syria.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Richard Dawkins is our guest, fresh off the Colbert Report, I believe. He's the author of, among other books, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, which is what we're talking about today. You had an anecdote you want to tell us about Julia Sweeney.
Julia Sweeney has a one-woman show called Letting Go of God, or some such title. I think it's called that. It's about her escape from Christianity, from Roman Catholicism. She was indoctrinated as a child as a Roman Catholic, and she escaped. And it's a moving story. It's a very funny story. And finally, she became an atheist, and it was announced in the newspaper that she was an atheist, and her mother telephoned her and said, in more or less hysterical tones, "I don't mind you if you don't believe in God, but an atheist?"
You say that people who deny evolution are no better than those who deny the Holocaust.
No, I didn't say that.
You didn't say that.
I said that they are both history deniers. I said that they are the same in that both of them deny manifest facts of history. I didn't say they're no better. I think that Holocaust deniers are worse because they are usually motivated by a malign, malevolent political agenda, which is anti-Semitism. I don't think that of creationists, but they do resemble Holocaust deniers in that they deny what is a palpable and manifest fact of history.
You wrote another book about evolution, but this one is the purpose of this one, The Greatest Show on Earth, is to lay out the facts in a way that people can understand them and approach them and understand them. But given the fact that there are people out there who will never accept this, and then there are people out there who already do, who is the audience for this book?
It's a good question. The people who will never accept it won't read it anyway.
Right.
They probably don't read any book, actually, except one. And actually, I wish they'd read that one a bit more carefully because they'd be shocked at what they found in the books of Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, etc. But who's the audience for my book? Well, it's not those who won't read a book at all. It's the millions of people who are on the fence, mm-hmm. who probably vaguely think of themselves as creationists because they never heard anything else. But they are persuadable because they simply haven't thought about it very much. And they might be curious, they might be interested, they might be actually fascinated mm-hmm. by the evidence, which is elegant and beautiful, actually stunningly beautiful. And those are the people that I'm aiming at, and I suspect that they're far more numerous. And quite a lot of those 40%, the 40%ers, mm-hmm. probably are in that category. I suspect that rather few of the 40% are the kind of closed-minded people who simply will regard anything contrary to Scripture as the work of the devil.
You mentioned Deuteronomy and Leviticus and a couple of other books of the Bible. Have you read the Bible as an atheist? Have you read it?
I have not read the Bible all through. I've got better things to do, but I probably know the Bible better than most people who call themselves religious, yes.
Okay. The Greatest Show on Earth is not, as I said, it's not an anti-religious book, but in that book, you talk about some of the arguments against evolution. You mention that people constantly bring up the missing fossil record.
Oh, God, yes.
Where's the missing link? Why haven't we found, if there's evolution, why haven't we found the missing link?
Well,
or have we?
There's no such thing as the missing link. In Victorian times, the missing link meant the missing link between humans and chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. Well, you're never going to find that literally because, of course, we're not descended from chimpanzees. Humans and chimpanzees are descended from a common ancestor who lived about 6 or 7 million years ago. What we now do have and which Darwin didn't have because they've been discovered since, is quite a lot of fossils which are intermediate between humans and the common ancestor with chimpanzees. There aren't any fossils between that common ancestor and chimpanzees, probably because they lived in forests, it's not good fossilizing conditions. But we now have quite a lot of fossils which are beautiful intermediates between some kind of an ape, which would have been a lot more like a chimpanzee, the ancestor, than like us. Ardipithecus ramidus, a new fossil, 4.4 million years ago, was just discovered, just reported rather, a couple of weeks ago. Very, very exciting fossil, walked on its hind legs, but it had an opposable big toe like a thumb. Beautiful fossil. And then Lucy a little bit more recently, various other fossils. They are very beautifully intermediate. More generally, missing links in the fossil record, missing links between fish and amphibians, for example. We're discovering them all the time.
I want to come back to what you just said. You said that man is not descended from the apes, and that opens up a whole world of thinking that perhaps many people haven't considered, because I kind of thought until I read that that somewhere there would be a link. But you're saying no, and what you're calling this is a hairpin bend.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, let me correct you on one point. When you said we're not descended from apes, we are apes. Okay, we're among the African apes. We are African apes like chimpanzees and gorillas, as opposed to Asian apes. So chimpanzees are closer to us than they are to orangutans. So we are apes. And our ancestors were apes. The common ancestor between humans and chimpanzees was an African ape, and then the common ancestor with orangutans is a more recent one. So we are descended from apes. We are not descended from chimpanzees, however, because chimpanzees are modern animals, just as we are modern animals. Chimpanzees are modern apes, just as we are modern apes. Okay. Now, it's a very common misconception that we're descended from chimpanzees, and so people will even say something like, well, if we're descended from chimpanzees, why are there still chimpanzees about? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, we're not descended from chimpanzees.
So it wasn't a moment of some sort of mutation that a chimpanzee mother suddenly gave birth to the first human being. It wasn't that. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that in any case, we're not descended from chimpanzees, but let's go back and take this common ancestor, let's call it X, the common ancestor with chimpanzees. It probably was a lot more like a chimpanzee than like us. There was never a moment when suddenly it gave birth to a baby which was human. There was never a moment when a human baby was born to a non-human mother. Mm-hmm. They were always the same species. It's always every child born is the same species as its parents.
So how does it happen? Because I want to get back to this hairpin bend.
Gradually, it happens gradually. Think about this. Every adult was once a child.
Okay.
But there was never a moment when a child woke up in the morning and suddenly said, oh, I seem to be an adult this morning. It doesn't happen suddenly. It happens gradually. But when you look with hindsight, mm-hmm. you can see that the adult is very different from the baby that it once was.
But you refer to this point, coming back to this hairpin bend, it's the point when what came before, and you use it as an example, a rabbit. What came before the rabbit could just as easily have become something else.
Yes. The point about the hairpin bend, it was a thought experiment that I put into the book, and it was really a rather different point. The point was that there is a trajectory of gradualness that connects any animal with any other animal. And I took a rabbit and a leopard, for example. Rabbits and leopards are both modern animals. But if you were to walk backwards through time, starting with modern rabbits, if you were to lay all the rabbits out next to their mother, so modern rabbit, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, etc., and you go through back millions and millions and millions of great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers, what you would see as you walk backwards in time would be a gradual change, gradual, 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 never sudden, until you hit what I call the hairpin bend ancestor, mm-hmm. which is the common ancestor between rabbits and leopards, and incidentally, between rabbits and lots of other mammals as well. You hit the common ancestor, which would have looked a bit like a shrew, actually. And then you turn round, that's why it's called a hairpin, and you start going forwards again in time. And you go forwards, and it gradually changes, and it branches and branches and branches to give rise to lots and lots and lots of mammals until eventually you come to a leopard. And there never, ever would be a sudden change. It would always be gradual as you go backwards in time to the hairpin, common ancestor, and then forwards in time to the modern animal, which might be a leopard. You could have gone forward to any other modern mammal you want. And it would the lesson is that there is a trajectory of gradual change which links every animal to every other animal if you imagine yourself walking backwards in time to the common ancestor and then forwards in time from the common ancestor to any other modern animal you like.
Now, for those who are still having difficulty accepting this, you go into you spend a whole chapter on animals like dogs. And we human beings have bred dogs to be various different characteristics, and we have over a long period of time the dogs themselves have evolved from wolves. If you just look at dogs or horses, which we've also bred, would that not be an argument for evolution?
Yes, it would. And it's one of the most powerful arguments that Darwin used. If you wanted to do an experimental test of the power of selection to guide evolution, what would you do? Well, you would select yourself. You would experimentally select. You'd take animals and you'd breed for some characteristic you want. So you would, for example, if you wanted a little pet to carry around with you, you could say, well, I'll start with a wolf and I'll breed for the smallest wolves that I can get, smaller and smaller and smaller. I'll give them cute expressions. I'll give them little snuffly noses and you end up with a Pekingese. A Pekingese is a relatively recent descendant of a wolf in terms of evolutionary time, geological time. It's the blink of an eye, but it happened gradually. It was guided by human selection as opposed to natural selection. Darwin pointed out that human selection is extremely powerful. It can cause massive evolutionary change. A Pekingese is really very unlike a wolf. Mm-hmm. Can cause massive evolutionary change in a relatively short time, a few centuries. Now, if you can do that in a few centuries, just think what you could do in 100 million years. That's the point. Now, it isn't humans who do the selecting over the 100 million years. It's nature. It's non-random life or death. Some individuals survive, other individuals don't survive. That's the only difference. Instead of a human breeder saying, I'll keep that puppy and kill that puppy, it's nature that says, doesn't say anything, of course, but one puppy survives, another puppy doesn't survive. Mm-hmm. And that's natural selection, and that working over hundreds of millions of years was powerful enough to change fish into humans.
Richard Dawkins is our guest. His book is called The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of calls. We have lots of people wanting to get involved in this conversation, and I have a ton of emails here as well and Facebook comments. Let's begin with Richard in Matthews. Welcome, Richard.
Yes, hi. It's a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you. Listening to your talk last night, I noticed a similarity between the way you characterized evolution with the way global warming is characterized, the characterization both in tone and language. Basically, people are saying, hey, the issue is settled, no reputable scientist disputes the evidence, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any comments on that in terms of the sort of science involved and the level of evidence and the sort of effort to sort of quash any disagreement? And then second, I know that's not your expertise. Secondarily, in your expertise, what about global warming and evolution? Is it something to be really concerned about, or is it just sort of a bump on the road and evolutionary forces will adapt?
Earlier in this broadcast, I mentioned quantum theory as something that I wasn't qualified to deal with, and that I was satisfied that the scientific method, peer review and so on, that there were scientists who are qualified to deal with it. Global warming is in that category. I could have read up about global warming. I'm sorry to say I haven't. And so I think, although I could say something vague as a citizen about global warming, since I just heard that we do have a lot of other calls, we'd probably be wasting our time if I were to talk about global warming. But thank you very much for raising the issue.
Richard, anything else?
Yeah. Well, and then what about evolutionary forces in light of global warming? If, in fact, it is the case, is it a real crisis to be concerned about, or is it?
If it is a real crisis to be concerned about, and I suspect it probably is, then it will indeed have massive evolutionary consequences because it's going to change the face of the world as the face of the world has been changed before, and this is going to massively change the selection pressures that bear upon not just us, of course, but on animals and plants generally.
Thank you for your call. Let me go to Lenore. Becky, you're on WFAE.
Yes, it's great to get to talk to you today. And I was going to ask sort of how, like, the attitude towards evolution, the unwillingness, like, to even look at the evidence, to even consider the different facts, how that contributes to the overall political climate, because it seems like it generalizes to pretty much every issue that we have going on today.
Yes, I mean, it is a remarkable fact that this issue seems to be tied up with politics generally, and it's as though it's become a political issue, rather like abortion and gay marriage and all sorts of other things. It's a kind of hot-button issue that people fret about politically. I'm a scientist. I'm committed to the evidence. If I don't know about something, I'll say so. I just said that about global warming. And I think that everybody should say, if they don't know anything about it, well, I don't know about it, so either I shut up or I will learn about it. And I'm afraid people don't do that. They don't say, well, I don't know anything about biology, so I'm going to either shut up or read something about it. They instead bracket it with a whole lot of other political issues and come out passionately convinced of something which they're not qualified to speak about.
Yeah, is there anything, do you have any suggestions on things that we can do to change it, or...
Well, only encourage people to sit down before the facts as a little child, as Thomas Huxley said, and take the evidence seriously instead of brandishing the sort of weapons of disgust and political anger that are dominating the discussion in America today.
Thank you for your call, Becky. Andrea writes an email. She says, in your talk last evening, you said that the human brain has evolved beyond that which is required for our survival. Humans can recognize beauty in art and can be deeply moved by music. What direction do you envision our brains will take as we continue to evolve?
Well, our brains may not continue to evolve. Our brains may stay as they are because natural selection may be weakened on humans. I don't know about that. What I do expect is that we shall continue to evolve culturally and technologically, especially in things like the internet, the rapid rise of computers, that's going to rapidly change the world in which we live.
Well, she brings that up. She says, technology has deeply influenced the way we live our day-to-day lives, from communication to our very survival. We no longer need to go out and hunt for food or even venture out to the store. We can just click on a website and have what we need delivered to our door. Do you see a far distant future where humans devolve to become more like machines?
Well, that is a possible science fiction scenario and a disquieting one in many respects. Maybe we will devolve. Maybe indeed we'll disappear altogether and machines may take over the world entirely. And I speculated last night about the possibility of some distant future when a similar room full of machines speculates about the possibility that in their remote ancestry they might have been created by soft, squishy, soft, wet things. Mm-hmm. There might have been a different form of life that wasn't made of metal and silicon. And that is possible. We may be doing ourselves out of existence in the distant future.
Richard Dawkins is our guest. He's the author of The God Delusion, River Out of Eden, Climbing Mount Improbable. All of these, I would take it, deal with God.
They deal with evolution.
And evolution. And the greatest show on earth is The Evidence for Evolution. And we'll come back to our conversation with Richard Dawkins in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for this rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's 4th of July Festival, featuring live music from Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers and Mo, plus fireworks on July 3rd and 4th. Details at usnwc.org. Coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, they'll have an update on the U.S. involvement in Iraq and Syria. Armed U.S. drones begin flying over Iraq to protect American military advisors. President Obama seeking authorization to provide military training and equipment to Syrian opposition fighters. The panel will discuss the latest on U.S. involvement in Iraq and Syria. That's the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Melissa Block with NPR News. Does All Things Considered keep you company on the way home from work or school every day? Would your weekends be not quite the same without Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or Car Talk? Well, if your favorite public radio programs have become inseparable parts of your daily routine, you're not alone. Now we're counting on you to join the WFAE community to help pay for the programming that you depend on. You can contribute online at WFAE.org. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Richard Dawkins is our guest. His latest book, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. You stress that evolution is not a simple continuous transition from one thing to the next over time, but a long, sometimes unrelated series of adaptations that have actually led to thousands and thousands of different animals. And that leads to a question that might be at the crux of many people's problems with this. I mentioned that there's a fear about accepting this among many people, but your explanation of evolution seems to suggest randomness.
Far from it.
Really?
Yes. What it is based upon is non-random selection. In every generation, the individuals who survive are the ones who are best equipped to survive, and that is non-random. It's super non-random. It's exactly what you mean by non-random.
Well, then maybe it's not, maybe my initial thought was wrong, but maybe it is that it seems to suggest that there's no one guiding the process.
It suggests that, all right, but that's very different from saying it's random. There are other ways of being non-random than being guided. Being guided is just one way of being non-random.
You have reprinted in this book a conversation with a creationist that you've had, which illustrates that one of the problems with convincing them of your point of view is that they simply won't listen. They ask for evidence, and when you give them the evidence, they say, yes, but give me some evidence.
Yes, precisely right.
And much later in the book, you point out that we can find evidence all over our own bodies.
Yes.
And those of other animals. Give me some examples.
Well, I suppose the most telling examples would be vestigial organs that don't do anything, but that used to do something. So, for example, in our genome, which is now being decoded, as you know, there are lots and lots and lots of genes that do nothing at all. But you can tell that they once did something because they resemble genes that do something. They're just vestiges. They're just scratch pad left on the hard disk now, with the hard disk of the genome.
Mm-hmm.
There are also legacies of history which actually cause us to suffer. The fact that so many people get back pain is because we not that long ago walked on all fours, and rising on your hind legs is a very radical shift, and it has consequences. If we had been designed to walk on our hind legs, we'd have been better designed to walk on our hind legs, and we wouldn't get back pain. I mean, there are other examples.
Well, yeah, you use the human eye as a good example. We would not have designed, if we were going to set out to design a camera for our body that allowed us to see the world around us, we wouldn't have designed it the way the eye.
A digital camera, a modern digital camera, has a whole a retina, we could call it, of light-sensitive cells, we could call them.
Mm-hmm.
And these are wired up from behind, obviously. Mm-hmm. The eye, the vertebrate eye, has a similar bank of cells, but they're wired up from in front.
So the wires are in front.
The wires are in front.
They're in our field of vision.
That's right. The wires get in the way of the light. What kind of a designer would ever have done that?
So you're saying it's not intelligent design, because there's an intelligent designer would have done it differently?
Certainly not intelligent design. Many aspects of it are very unintelligent. However, natural selection is extremely good at coming along afterwards and tinkering and kind of bodging it up and getting it right after the event.
From our Facebook page, Denise writes, Richard Dawkins stereotypes Christians as fundamentalist and hostile to science and evolution. I wish he understood that there are many Christians out here who have great appreciation for the beauty of science and nature. I believe God is the master scientist and mathematician. To be a scientist is to have a privileged insight into the majesty of God. I would enjoy his books much more if he could leave out his hostility toward Christians. On the other hand, Mike writes, in response to Denise, Mr. Dawkins isn't hostile toward Christians. He respects the science, not faith. I don't blame him for being short with the nonsense of creationism and its proponents. The proponents of creationism do nothing but confuse real science for superstitious garbage. You want to comment on that?
Yes, I think that perhaps Denise didn't hear the beginning of the program, mm-hmm. where, in response to your question, I said that bishops and theologians all accept evolution. And I was actually rather sorry for them. I actually expressed my regret that they have to contend with the idiots who believe that the world is only 10,000 years old. So I did express sympathy for exactly Denise's position.
And Eric writes, why are atheists always talking about religion? I get so sick of both sides telling the other what to believe. The atheists always tell people how dumb they are for believing, and the believers always try to convert the atheists. Let's talk about the word belief.
I would not talk about religion at all if it were not the case that children all over America and all over Britain are being continuously brainwashed mm-hmm. into beliefs which they should be allowed to be free to think for themselves about. I am absolutely fed up with hearing from science teachers that they have to be actually look over their shoulder for fear of losing their jobs because they're teaching their science. If religious people would just shut up and let people follow the evidence where it will, then of course we wouldn't be talking about religion all the time. It is a response to the domination of religion, the domination by religion, mm-hmm. which pervades education in this country.
Okay. There's an article just a few days ago in the LA Times about you, and it says, Dawkins is very keen to establish that his new book is not the God delusion. He wants as much as possible to distance it from conversations about God. True?
This book, The Greatest Show on Earth, contains nothing that any serious theologian or bishop or professor of theology could object to. That's exactly the point that Denise was making in the first of the emails that you read out. I've not denied my atheism, but that's another book. That is The God Delusion.
Okay. And finally, from Tim, before we go back to the phones, Tim writes, if you haven't read The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins, chances are you do not understand evolution. It is fascinating, well-written, and you don't have to be a scientist to understand it. Highly recommended. Let me go back to the phones and to Mondale. Reggie, you could be our first caller from Mondale. I don't even know where that is. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I think Mr. Dawkins has already made the point that I was going to try and make.
Okay.
That's simply that Christianity and evolution are not really at odds. The Bible basically is the old stories are people's attempt to explain how we got where we were with a very hugely different mindset on how the world was. The ancient Jews believed that the world was flat. It had a dome over it that contained the water so that when it rained, basically that dome got a little rip in it and some of the water that was surrounding them fell into it. Just a hugely, hugely different mindset. And you couldn't 4, 5, 10,000 years ago go on and we were all kind of descended from the same ancestors. That their mind would never have grasped that concept. So the Bible, if you will, if you want to look at it, is man's evolution about his thinking about God. And it starts off with what today we would call very primitive, but for the day and time that it existed, was a revolutionary and radical concept by the Jews, opposed to, say, any other ancient religion. Basically, if you look at other creation stories, basically the world created as a result of a fight between a couple of gods mm-hmm. or, you know, wars.
Well, we're not here to talk about religion necessarily, but do you want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I would just say that the Jewish creation myth is just one of thousands of creation myths, and many of them are indeed very beautiful, but none of them have any basis. In fact, we now do know a lot more. And so creation myths should be treated as what they are. They are myths, and there's certainly nothing special about the Jewish one. It's just one of thousands.
Thank you for your call, Reggie. Let me go to Mark in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Welcome, Dr. Dawkins, to Charlotte. I hope you enjoy the weather. Probably reminds you a lot of home.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have a comment. Go ahead.
I do. Just a simple question. Where did it all begin? What started the ball rolling, so to speak? There's a lot of talk about this started from that, and I'm a peripheral viewer to the discussion. discussion and just...
Yeah, that's a very good question. The Darwin's theory starts when life began. It doesn't explain how life began, and Darwin explicitly said that. We still don't know how life began. It's a great gap in our knowledge. We're working on it. Maybe it'll be solved one day, maybe it won't. What I would say is that even if there is a gap in our scientific knowledge, what that should not mean to you is that therefore we need to postulate a designer. That doesn't help because you still don't know where the designer came from. What you should say if we have a gap in our scientific knowledge is, let's do some more science, and that's what we're doing.
Well, on the one hand, you say we don't have to look toward a master designer, a god, a supreme being, but you almost sound like a creationist in this book when you say, it is no accident that we see green almost everywhere we look. It is no accident that we find ourselves perched on one tiny twig in the midst of a blossoming and flourishing tree of life. No accident that we are surrounded by millions of other species, eating, growing, rotting, swimming, flying, walking, etc. That sounds like a plan.
Oh, no, it doesn't. That's an argument from hindsight. It's sometimes called the anthropic principle.
Okay.
Because of the way the theory of evolution works, we couldn't be here if we were the only species around. Mm-hmm. Any species can only exist as a member of a great ecosystem of millions of other species, and especially they've got to be plants. That's why we see green wherever we are. The fact that we see anything at all, the fact that we exist and see anything at all, implies that we have to be surrounded by a support system which includes green plants.
What does the awareness of our existence mean to you?
It means that we have powerful brains which have been shaped by natural selection to be aware. And this would have been useful in our ancestral past. We needed to be aware of what we had to be aware of to survive in our ancestral past.
But we're aware of our own mortality. Now, we assume that animals are not, other animals are not, but could they be? Could dolphins, could whales be aware of their own mortality?
Who knows? I mean, we don't know that, of course. We are aware of our own mortality, and it is disturbing to many people, and this probably lies behind a lot of the religious impulse, I suspect.
Okay. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Stacy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just had a question about, you talked about the rabbit versus the leopard, I believe it was. I just wanted to know your thoughts on imprinting in different animals and different species and how maybe that has evolved and why we may not know so much about human imprinting if it exists.
I don't quite see the connection between rabbits and leopards and imprinting, but imprinting is the phenomenon that was described by Conrad Lawrence, whereby young goslings, young ducklings, young chicks imprint on their parent. The first thing they see, the first large moving object they see when they come out of the egg, is the thing that they will follow as ducklings, and the thing to which they will try to mate with. It's a model for what they'll try to mate with later in life. Imprinting could be regarded as a sort of metaphor for the period in early life when humans are particularly vulnerable to whatever it is that they're told. Maybe we do imprint on certain ideas that are put into our heads at a young age in something like the same way as young ducklings and goslings imprint on the parent figure. I'm not sure if that's what you mean by bringing up imprinting, but it's an interesting thought.
Stacy, thank you for your call. Allison in Cramerton, welcome to the program.
Hi. I very much believe in evolution, but when you argue at that point with other Christians, the first thing they say is, well, how'd that start? I mean, explain, and I don't really know how to explain that to people. Like, what would, I guess what you just said is you need more scientific research.
So it goes back to the Big Bang. How do you explain that?
I think what she's talking about is not the Big Bang, but the origin of life, probably.
Okay. Right.
Both of them are gaps in our knowledge. Mm-hmm. The origin of life, we don't know how it happened, as I just said before. The most promising theory at the moment is the so-called RNA world theory, and I do discuss that in the book. The idea is that RNA, which is a bit like DNA but different, does have some of the properties which might make it suitable for starting life out. DNA is not suitable to be the very first genetic material. The problem of the origin of life is, where did the first genetic material come from? Once you've got something like a gene, then it can all go like almost like clockwork. But RNA may be the key, and I haven't time to go into it now, but it is in the book.
Thank you for your call, Allison. Joe in Hickory writes, I was at Dana last night to hear Professor Dawkins speak. As usual, he did not disappoint. What more evidence do we Americans need regarding the sorry state of affairs in science education than noted scientists from other countries demonstrating it? When will we finally get the message? Science education in this country needs to be reworked from the ground up, emphasizing critical thinking and the essential role played by evidence. I've taken this approach in my astronomy and physics courses for several years. Both I and my students find it superior to traditional instruction. I work at Catawba Valley Community College, but public school teachers are frequently discouraged from any form of innovation that doesn't revolve around the end of course testing. Thus, the cycle cannot be broken in that environment. Specific question for Dr. Dawkins. Do you distinguish between philosophy and religion? Some regard Buddhism as more of a philosophy than a religion. Does this dichotomy exist for Christianity?
Yes, first of all, I should say it's not just scientists from abroad who say these things. There are, of course, many excellent American scientists doing the same thing. For example, Jerry Coyne and Kenneth Miller, who's a devout Christian, by the way, who's one of the most eloquent defenders of evolution. Philosophy and religion, yes, Buddhism could be regarded as a philosophy. It's a kind of way of life. Buddhists may or may not be theists. Some of them are, and some of them are not. Of course, we do need a philosophy of life, and many philosophies of life have been offered. They certainly don't have to postulate anything supernatural. In the case of morals, for instance, moral philosophy is a very advanced branch of philosophy involving very brilliant people. Nothing to do with religion.
I think I know the answer to this, but I ask it just in case, and I have 10 seconds. Why the title, The Greatest Show on Earth?
Life is the greatest show on Earth, and the fact that we understand it through evolution is a wonderful experience for the human mind.
Dr. Richard Dawkins, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. It's completely understandable. Even I can read it and understand it, so that, and it's a science book, so I, that's saying a lot. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.